Okay, well, it's a real pleasure to give this talk after Beverly's talk, because she managed to cover in great detail the subject of classical singularities. And so what that means is that in this talk, I can just sort of hit a few high notes, and in various places I can say, as Beverly told you, da-da-da-da-da. So anyway, I'm going to tell you about some recent work on the behavior of singularities and using numerical simulations to do those. So in Beverly's talk, she sort of outlined a general method for what to do and took you up to the case where there is one symmetry. And a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is the case where there's no symmetry at all. So general references on the subject can be found in Beverly's Living Review article, but the sort of new stuff with no symmetry at all, if you want the details, you can find them, for example, in these three papers. Okay, so here's a quick outline of the talk. So I'm going to remind you what gravitational collapse is, what singularities are, a little bit about the BKL conjecture, and then what I'm going to do is to sort of tell you about, in some sense, the beginning and end of the story, and I get to skip the middle because Beverly covered that. So some of the first spacetimes looked at numerically are the Gaudi spacetimes, the case with two symmetries, and then I'm going to tell you in a little bit of detail about those, and then I'm going to skip to the case of no symmetry at all, and then in the end I'm going to make some general remarks about the implications of all this for quantum treatment of singularities. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. We all know that stars are in general kept in equilibrium. Gravity tries to pull them in. Pressure gradients try to push them out. And these two are sort of in an uneasy truce in which they balance each other out. But we also know that this truce is held in place because when you compress things, their pressure gets bigger. So that tends to make it hard to compress them more. But the problem is that when you compress things, their gravity also gets stronger. And so it's possible that one could have a situation where the object compresses more and more, and at every stage, even though the pressure is getting stronger, gravity is getting stronger too, and the whole thing undergoes complete gravitational collapse. And this does actually happen for sufficiently massive stars at the end of their lives. Okay, so one can always study cases that have lots of symmetry and idealized models of various types of matter and see what things happen then. But one would like to have some kind of confidence that the thing being studied occurs in general. And an enormous step in this direction is given by the singularity theorems of Penrose, Hawking, and various other people that basically say the following. Once a trapped surface forms, that is, once gravity gets so strong that it can drag back light, given some energy and causality conditions that Gary alluded to and Beverly alluded to, some observer or light ray ends in a finite amount of time. So these singularity theorems are really wonderful because they tell you that singularities form under very general circumstances. And these singularity theorems are really horrible because they tell you almost nothing about what happens. All they tell you is that for some reason, some light ray or observer ends after some amount of finite time. They don't tell you why, they don't tell you how, they don't tell you who ends, they don't, you know, tell you anything except, you know, at some point some disaster happens and we're not going to tell you anything else. Okay, so how do you go beyond this? Well, at this point, we all might be tempted to sort of, you know, throw up our hands and give up, right? Because even the classical Einstein field equations are fairly complicated. Their singularities might be fairly complicated too. And so, you know, what hope do we have of getting any general understanding of this phenomenon? But it turns out that we do have hope. And the reason why is the following. What a singularity means, or what we think it means, is that certain physical quantities are blowing up. So what that means is that since things are described by the Einstein field equations, some terms in the Einstein field equations are blowing up. If they all blow up at the same rate, no simplification. But if some terms in the equation blow up more rapidly than others, that means we ought to be able to come up with a good approximation that just says we're going to keep the most rapidly blowing up stuff, we're going to throw away all the rest of the terms. Now we have this truncated set of equations that's much simpler than the original Einstein field equation, and we just deal with the truncated equations, and the truncated equation should give us an excellent approximation to what's going on at the singularity. Okay, great idea, but how do we know which terms in the equations are the dominant ones and which ones aren't? And even if we have a guess as to which ones are the dominant ones and which aren't, how do we know whether our guess is right or not? Okay, so the first part of this question, which terms in the equation do we think are the important ones, was actually done by Belinsky, Kolatnikov, and Lifshitz in the late 60s and early 70s. And roughly speaking, their guess, their conjecture, is that the important terms in the Einstein field equations are the time derivative terms, and that the spatial derivative terms are much less important. So at this point, Gary and Abai, having been trained in the old Chicago style of doing relativity, are supposed to, you know, jump up and throw down the gauntlet and object violently that, you know, what do you mean by time derivatives and spatial derivatives? What is your foliation? What are your coordinates? You know, how can this statement possibly make any sense whatsoever? It's not geometrical, you know, this, that, and the other thing. I'm going to save them the difficulty of, you know, jumping up and, you know, throwing down the gauntlet. You know, let's just consider that, you know, they've jumped up and some virtual gauntlet has been thrown down. And let me just say that sometime, you know, in this talk, I will address those issues. And so if at the end of the talk you guys are still not satisfied, you know, then you can actually, you know, jump up for real and object for real.
Not that one.
Oh, you have another objection too. Okay. Yeah.
So here, when one says in the previous transparency, mm-hmm. I explained, I mean, singularity does not mean curvature blows up or anything in the sense of singularity theorem. It's some incompleteness of geodesic. But here, you mean curvature singularity. Is that correct?
Right. I mean, so the idea is, one of the annoying things about the sort of study of singularities is that one can always construct, you know, special cases in which, you know, okay, only one observer, you know, ends for various things, and, you know, all right, it's technically singular, but all sorts of other things are going on. But what I have in mind is that, you know, and this is yet another conjecture, that in the general case, things do behave the way that, you know, we expect them to. Namely, you make a trapped surface, and, you know, we really do get curvature blow up, and you do get a whole bunch of things happening. And this is also something to be checked. So, yes, there will always be special cases, there will always be counterexamples, there will always be things where, you know, if you set up the initial conditions in this very special way, then things happen differently. But what I'm concerned with here is the generic case.
Sue Scott had a program to actually show this, right? That in fact, whenever singularity theorems imply that there is singularity, under some conditions, is a curvature singularity. Or anybody in the room know anything about what the status of that is?
Well, I mean, so she does do that, but the trouble is there are all these things like the work of Pyotr Krushel and Vince Moncrief and Jim Eisenberg. Maybe you know some other people in the cast of characters. Where they basically show that there are sort of particular cases of the Gaudi spacetimes where, you know, part of the what you think is going to be the singularity is actually something that's not really singular, and you can sneak around it and things like that. So I'm sort of pessimistic about Susan Scott's program. I mean, she may very well, you know, she does have some theorems, and, you know, there are some results, and she may be able to push it a certain way. But in some sense, these, you know, sort of special Gaudi spacetimes that Krushel and Moncrief and I guess others have examined will always be something that in some sense gets around that. Okay, so anyway, so this is the first part. You know, we need a guess as to which terms to throw away. From the sort of late 60s to the early 90s, things stood there. The question now comes, how do you tell if that guess is right? In the early 90s, Beverly Berger and Vince Moncrief started out on a program of research that basically said, well, what you do is you perform some numerical simulations of gravitational collapse, and you know, you see whether, in fact, this conjecture is correct or not. Okay, so now I'm going to go to the first part of the numerical story, the spacetimes that Berger and Moncrief first looked at, the Gaudi spacetimes. And then later on, I'm going to skip all the middle stuff and then tell you about the generic stuff. Okay, so in the Gaudi spacetimes, you assume that you have space as a three torus, so just a closed universe with T3 topology. You assume that you have two spatial symmetries, so things don't depend on the coordinates y and z, only on x and t. So what you want to do is you want to think of this as being sort of a closed three torus universe where you have plane gravitational waves running around the torus, and they're interacting with each other, and this interaction eventually causes gravitational collapse. Okay, so the nice thing about this is that it's simple enough that you only have a few metric components, they only depend on a couple of variables, and so we can now write down the Einstein field equations in just a couple of lines. And here they are. So for a metric of that form, there are these three metric functions, p, q, and lambda. Once you know what p and q are, you can find lambda using quadratures. And so the main thing that goes on are these sort of funny things that look a little bit like wave equations for p and q. Now, I should say a little bit, I should probably go back, about this coordinate t. So if you look closely, you can see that the area of the two tori of symmetry goes to zero as this coordinate t goes to infinity. So you want to think of the t as being a sort of logarithmic coordinate, something where it takes forever in the coordinate time to reach the singularity, even though it's easy to show that it only takes a finite amount of proper time to reach the singularity. So for numerical simulations, this is something that's very handy to have as a time coordinate, right? I mean, once you actually hit a singularity, the computer has to stop. Unless it's doing Abbe's equations, in which case you can keep on going. But if you're doing the plain old Einstein equations, once you hit a singularity, the computer says, I have computed an infinite number, I must stop. So one nice thing to use as a coordinate is something where it actually takes an infinite amount of coordinate time to reach the singularity. And then you can read off the behavior of the singularity as the asymptotic behavior as coordinate time goes to infinity of your simulation. So this particular coordinate, since it's basically the logarithm of the area of these two tori, is something that does indeed go to infinity as the singularity is approached. Okay, so now we have the Einstein field equations on just a couple of lines, where here a subscript means derivative. So this PTT means second derivative of P with respect to time. QT means derivative of Q with respect to time. QXX means second derivative of Q with respect to the spatial coordinate X, and so on. Okay, so now, at least for these simple models, we're in a position to come up with this notion of what does it mean that the spatial derivatives become negligible as the singularity is approached. So the first thing that you want to notice is that Everything that has a spatial derivative also has an e to the minus 2t. So you stare at these equations for a few seconds and you say, oh, okay, as t goes to infinity, e to the minus 2t is really small. All the spatial derivatives are multiplied by e to the minus 2t. Therefore, it seems likely that as t goes to infinity, the spatial derivatives are negligible, and we're all set. So this is something where you can at least sort of formulate the BKL conjecture, and you have some notion that, well, okay, maybe something like this is true.
There is that p could grow linearly at t,
right? Right. So this is good. So that's what I'm about to say on my next transparency. Let's see. Yeah. Well, I'll skip a couple of transparencies and then come back. Okay. In fact, if you take a look at the other equations, you find that p does in fact grow linearly, and so the naive expectation is something that you had better worry a little bit about, because it's not clear that this term really is going to become negligible or not. Okay, so, yeah?
So there's sort of a question of, well, there's this idea of local homogeneity, right? But it's homogeneous on sort of what scales? What's the correct comparison?
As I'll show you in a minute, it's not homogeneity at all. In other words, if you look at how things behave, what you'll find is that, in fact, they have all sorts of nasty variations as a function of space. In the field equations themselves, nonetheless, that dependence on space appears at a subdominant level because it's multiplied by this tiny prefactor. So local homogeneity doesn't say anything at all about the dependence on space is becoming small. All it says is the dependence on space when it comes into the field equations is unimportant because it's multiplied by a small factor. So that's all that local homogeneity means.
Yeah. You could also very easily, get rid of all those factors of e to the minus t by, doing an appropriate coordinate transformation. So, I guess
you could scale things up.
I'm not sure what it means.
What you do is you start out with, some initial data for these equations, and then you evolve them and see what happens. Okay? So staring at these equations, we have naively reason to believe that the spatial derivatives are going to become negligible, but then, as Gary points out, we also have reason to worry about that. But the real answer is the one, given by Beverly and Vince, namely, well, okay, evolve it and see what happens. Okay,
if I had picked the other coordinate system, you're saying I wouldn't have noticed, and I would have just evolved it.
It's the same system of equations, no matter what coordinates you use. But in this set of coordinates, it's easier to guess what's going to become negligible and what won't. Okay, so before I get into the results, let me say a little bit about the numerical methods. So for many physicists, numerical methods are basically consist of two black boxes, which you use, but you don't worry much about what's inside of them. So one of these black boxes is called Mathematica, or if you're north of the Canadian border, Vapel. The other black box is your friendly neighborhood computational physicist, where you say, Matt, Franz, or Luis, or David, I've got a set of equations, put them on the computer and tell me what the answer is. These are two perfectly good black boxes, but from time to time, it's a good idea to sort of look inside the black box and find out what it's actually doing. The stuff inside the black box is not all that bad. So I want to say a little bit about the methods that are used, because in fact they really are fairly simple, and so in some circumstances, if Mathematica doesn't do the trick, it might actually be worthwhile to sort of code up your own equations yourself. So here's the idea. What we're doing in the end is always just solving a bunch of differential equations. And the idea on a computer is to basically use the finite difference method. So rather than having the function everywhere, you have it on a bunch of grid points. You basically replace derivatives by finite differences. So at grid point I, the first derivative is f at I plus 1 minus f at I minus 1 over 2 dx, and the second derivative has this slightly more complicated formula that looks like this. So in the stuff I gave you before, just, you know, imagine that all the spatial derivatives are being replaced by this. Well, you still have to evolve, so you need to do something with time derivatives. So one nice simple method is something called the iterated Kreg-Nicholson method. Introduce some more variables so you can write this thing in first order in time, that is, make all the first time derivatives separate variables. So now the evolution equation is of the form time derivative of S equals W, which depends in some way on S and its spatial derivatives. You can rewrite this way. This basically says S at time step n plus 1 minus S at time step n divided by dt is W halfway between time step n and time step n plus 1. Well, at first that doesn't look all that useful because, hey, you don't know S at time step n plus 1, but you can solve this equation iteratively. Take a guess for S at time step n plus 1. Your first guess is just, well, it doesn't change. It's what it was at time step n. And then plug in and iterate as many times as you like. That gives you S at time step n plus 1. So for the equations I showed you before, that really is all there is to it. You can simulate those equations just, you know, using finite differences for spatial derivatives and this thing for time derivatives, or any number of similar methods. Okay.
You brought this up. This is a nice method because it has good stability properties, fast convergence, or
what? Good stability properties, yeah. But there are other methods that have nice stability properties, too. So what happens when you take, you know, some initial data for P and Q and you evolve them with those equations? What you get is just the sort of thing that you would expect from those equations. So if we go back to the equations and we just knock off all of these spatial derivatives, we're just left with the stuff to the left of this line. Okay, so these are just ordinary differential equations, which we can in fact solve in closed form, and you can read off from them that P should go to some function of x plus t times some other function of x, and Q should go to some function of x. And this is, in fact, what happens in the simulations.
Can they be smaller than the suppression you have?
So to get back to Gary's question, if V naught is smaller than 1, then you're fine. Everything is still negligible. But if V naught is bigger than 1, then you're in trouble. And for reasons that I'm not going to get into, but that Beverly actually talked about yesterday, there really is a mechanism that drives V naught below 1. You find this nice behavior. Okay, but this mechanism that drives V naught below 1 is absent at certain isolated points, as Beverly also said yesterday, and so you get these sort of nasty spikes. That's still okay, but it's sort of a challenge for any numerical method. I mean, if you're looking at things that just depend on one spatial dimension, you can throw lots of spatial points at this. But if you're looking at things that depend on three different spatial dimensions, then doing things in a way that sort of resolves the spikes is going to be a little bit tricky. And I'll get back to that issue a little bit later. It's continuous, but the width of the spike shrinks exponentially with time. So what that means is that eventually, even if you have some nice adaptive mesh refinement algorithm at hand, the spike is going to get so narrow that it's going to defy the resolution of your machine. So Everything at any given time is always continuous, but eventually things get nasty enough that they overwhelm the algorithm. Yeah, Beverly?
Maybe this is time to point out that you do end up with an asymptotically velocity term dominated solution. The spatial location of the spikes is fixed, whereas if you end up with local mixed master dynamics, they move around, which make it an even worse challenge.
Yeah.
The model you're talking about now is where the asymptotically velocity term dominates.
Yes.
And therefore, like a finite number of spikes from the given solution that there's layers.
That's right. Okay, and then, you know, here's sort of similar behavior in Q. Once again, everything is nice, but there are these spikes that get ever narrower as time goes on, and so this is a bit of a numerical challenge. Okay, so now I'm going to skip over all the stuff in the middle, that is all the stuff that Beverly spent the second half of her talk on. So once you've tackled the case with two symmetries, you want to move on to the case with one symmetry, and you get lots of results there, but what you really want to do is the case with no symmetry at all. The case with no symmetry at all has in some sense been cracked recently, and it uses a slightly different method from what's usual in numerical relativity. So actually, I mean, in some sense, it's nice that this is, you know, not mostly an audience of numerical relativists, but is some mixed audience that uses all sorts of approaches to Einstein's equation. So in some sense, to many people, this will look a little bit more familiar. So the idea is that it turns out that instead of writing things in terms of spatial metrics and extrinsic curvatures or components of a metric, that it's much easier to treat the general case by working in terms of a tetrad. So you have some unit vector, unit time-like vector E0 that basically points in the direction of time evolution, and then you have a bunch of spatial metrics. A spatial triad, E alpha. And the basic variables are essentially the commutators of the tetrad vectors. So in particular, the commutator of spatial and time tetrad vectors has some pieces that I want to draw your attention to. So in particular, this piece, H, is the average expansion, and if this were a Robertson-Walker universe, it would be the Hubble parameter. This quantity sigma is the shear. It's essentially the time derivative of the beta quantities that Beverly was talking about the other day. So roughly speaking, if I have H but no shear, then that means a sphere basically expands but stays spherical, and if I have a shear, then a sphere turns into an ellipsoid. Then there are these other things, which I don't have any simple physical interpretation for, but Abai probably does because he plays around with them a lot. So these are basically commutators of triad variables, and they give rise to various pieces. I'm going to refer to these loosely as spatial curvature, although they should really be considered spatial twist coefficients. Basically, the idea is that if space is flat, then the unit vectors can commute among each other, but if space is not flat, then the unit vectors can't commute, and these pieces talk about the lack of commutation among the spatial vectors and therefore tell us something about the amount that space is curved. But they tell us about it in the way that a Christoffel symbol does, not in the way that a Riemann tensor does.
Do you come into it?
Yeah.
Since you mentioned this, describe this as a shear and an expansion, should I think of E0 as following the geodesic congruence, or is this some shear expansion of an arbitrary set of world?
Basically, a foliation is picked, and I'll talk a little bit later about how that's done. And E0 is just the normal to the foliation. Yeah, so it's just the normal congruence of the foliation. I'll say a little bit about later about what this foliation is. So let's see. Eva, you had a question?
Yeah, so are you committing to a particular topology, or where would that fit in?
For ease of numerical simulation, I'm only using topology T3. In principle, one could, you know, use all sorts of topologies, but T3 is the easiest numerically, and we haven't gotten beyond that yet.
That's okay. So was not, you couldn't do, for example, negative curvature.
No, there's no barrier except, you know, ease of numerical methods. Steve?
It's basically torsion,
or not? Well, I mean, there's sort of a torsion-free connection, so I'm not sure, you know, quite what that would be. I mean, this is just sort of another way of calculating the connection, right? I mean, the usual way that we calculate the connection is we say, okay, you have a metric and you calculate the Christoffel symbols, and another way you can calculate it in the tetrad, or I guess in this case the triad formalism, is to just say, well, if you want to know how things behave, you just look at the commutators of the unit vectors. So it's just relativity by other methods, and in fact, you know, these are the methods that Abai likes. So you can ask him for sort of the intuition.
It's a connection. Mm-hmm.
So okay, it's another one. Yeah.
Okay. So this is basically what you start with. So far, I haven't, you know, said anything special. I've just said, you know, instead of using metrics, we're going to use tetrads. It's another sort of standard method in relativity. Okay, but now here's where things change a little bit. What we're going to do is to define new variables, which are basically the old variables divided by the average expansion. And the reason why this is important is because things will blow up as one goes towards the singularity, but in some sense they're not going to blow up any faster than H. And so by defining these scale invariant variables, which are the physical variables divided by H, the stuff on the left is something that we actually expect to remain bounded as the singularity is approached. And in fact, as I'll show later on, we actually expect this one to go to zero, and that will give a nice precise definition of what it means for spatial derivatives to become negligible.
So H in this case is still a function of position.
Yes.
Average only in terms of averaging the direction.
Yeah. Well, so now I guess I should say a little bit more about the foliation. So there's actually two different versions of this system that I've used. The point is that you want the foliation to again be something where you have a time coordinate that goes to infinity as you approach the singularity. So one thing that you expect to happen as you approach the singularity is to have mean curvature, to have H blow up. One nice simple thing to do is to just use constant mean curvature foliation. Okay, so in that case, H really is constant, and you're just dividing through by the constant mean curvature, and everything is fine. The original system, as suggested by Ugla et al., is slightly more complicated. There, what you do is you choose any initial slice that you want, but then you flow it by inverse mean curvature flow. So the bigger the mean curvature is, the slower it goes, and so it takes forever in coordinate time to hit the singularity. So you can do it either way. Probably the simplest way to think about it is the constant mean curvature case. So H is just constant, and you're just scaling out by that constant. Okay, but in any case, the idea is that we used to have some Einstein field equations for these physical things, and since we're scaling out this quantity H, we now get Einstein field equations for these scale invariant things. Okay, so here's, you know, sort of in words what I just said. In terms of these scale invariant variables, the vacuum Einstein equations just become a set of partial differential equations. For the foliation, we want slicings that take forever to get to the singularity, and two simple ways to do this are either just to choose constant mean curvature slices or just to pick any old initial slice and flow it by inverse mean curvature flow. Either one of these works, and they both work numerically.
So David,
yeah.
On T3, then it's truly right that generically there's a unique CMC slicing.
I don't.
Is that true?
I don't know of any results. I mean, there are always these. So we really need to ask Doug Eardley about this, right? He seems to have spent enormous amounts of time figuring out when there is and isn't foliation by constant mean curvature surfaces. I'm going to take the naive numerical relativist prerogative that basically says I can always cook up some initial data on a constant mean curvature slice, and then my program is going to evolve it, and I'm going to see what happens. Now, at this point, Abai and Gary are again supposed to, jump up and throw down the gauntlet and say, well, you can do that and you'll get to the end of your foliation, but how do you know that you've really hit the singularity? And the answer, of how I know I've hit the singularity is, well, look, if everything is blowing up, then I have hit the singularity. And in particular, it's easy enough to calculate physical quantities like Riemann tensor squared in terms of the mean curvature of the slices and in terms of these scale invariant variables, and to verify that, yes, indeed, physical quantities really are blowing up as you get to the end of the simulation, and therefore I really do have the whole spacetime. So I don't have any sort of theorems in my back pocket about you can absolutely always have a constant mean curvature foliation which will do the trick, but I can always cook up some initial data, evolve it, and see what happens. And as long as I've covered the whole space time with my evolution, then I'm happy.
I guess you're more interested in the uniqueness question than the existence, just because maybe I'm jumping ahead. But in the beginning, you suggested that Gary and Abai should challenge you about what is the reference frame or coordinate system in which the time derivatives dominate. And you're going to say something like, well, the CMC slicing gives one answer. But I'm trying to understand, is that a unique slicing in general? If I didn't have toroidal boundary conditions, for example.
Well, I don't think I really need to worry about that, because you want to think of this in terms of a sort of phase space picture, right? I mean, so the phase space of a physical system is just the same as the sort of space of initial data, right? So you have some legal initial data, and then it sort of wanders around. So if there's more than one foliation, all that means is, well, I could get the same spacetime in two different ways by choices of initial data. But I don't care about that, because all I'm doing is I'm doing an exploration of what happens to some reasonable set of initial data. Now, you can and should worry about the fact that, hey, I only get a choice of one initial data set per simulation, and simulations take a little while to run, and so there's no way I'm going to be able to explore all of phase space or even any sort of large portion of phase space. And there, all I can say is, well, I try to sort of choose something that doesn't look too special and see what happens, and then guess that that's generic behavior. But that's the best I can do.
What I'm trying to understand is whether every space-like singularity somehow defines an associated time-like vector field near it that tells you in which direction dynamics is interesting and in which direction dynamics decouples.
Yeah, so that I don't know. I mean, in particular, because of this local mixmaster behavior, it's going to be very hard to come up with a notion of the phase space at the singularity. Now, in the scalar field case, you really can do that. There is this result due to Rendell and Anderson that does exactly what you want, at least in the neighborhood of the singularity.
You don't need a vector field. I mean, you need an equivalence class of vector fields, because if you just add a spatial direction, supposing one vector field works,
yes,
and if you just add a spatial vector field,
yes,
so long as the coefficient is not going down, so like,
yes,
then it's also allowed. Right? So then the derivative along that vector field is also going to dominate.
I see.
So there's going to be an equivalence class that actually defines.
I see. Very good. Thanks.
I mean, if I put it in more practical terms, if you run your code and confirm the conjecture, and mm-hmm. I grab your code, change the slicing, and don't confirm the conjecture, would you be surprised?
Yes. Definitely. Although, again, I mean, in the CMC case, at least, you may not be free to change the slicing. But at least in the inverse mean curvature case, yes, I'd be very surprised. Yeah, Veronica?
Is it clear that as you march up in time that your constant mean curvature slices manage to be sort of to the future, that it's really slicing the spacetime, that somehow they're going to to each other?
Sure. So the constant mean curvature equations basically reduce to an elliptic equation for the lapse, which tells you how much you march. So as long as that lapse is a positive function, you know, which it basically is, I'm always marching to the future. I mean, one could probably prove that because it's a little bit easier to get a handle on elliptic equations than hyperbolic ones. I don't have a proof in my back pocket, but it seems likely that things work that way. So let me say a little bit about the results. So basically the idea is that you run the simulations and sure enough the spatial derivatives do become negligible. And they don't become negligible because things are becoming homogeneous. They're not. Just like in the Gaudi case, things are becoming nasty in all sorts of ways, but every single spatial derivative is multiplied by this rescaled frame variable, capital E, which is going to zero, and so their contribution to the Einstein field equations is becoming negligible. So this local homogeneity is kind of a funny thing in the sense that, you know, nothing is smoothing out in any way. Rather, you know, things are getting more and more spiky as time goes on, but it's happening in such a way that the effect of spatial variation on the Einstein field equations becomes negligible. Yeah, Steve, and then Gary.
If you took the metric and performed just an overall Weyl rescaling on it, then you would see. So if you just blow it up, then in a sense, in that picture, it's becoming locally homogeneous, isn't it?
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Well, just rescale the metric by an overall factor.
Well, so if I rescale the metric by an overall factor, that doesn't change the Einstein tensor at all, and so it's still a solution. I mean, it's just really basically the same solution.
No, but you would have a big region that is approximately homogeneous once you blew it out of that. No, it did have some proper size. It's big because you've rescaled it.
Well, I mean, so you could imagine doing some kind of rescaling where you look at the spatial scale that's big enough to become as important as the corresponding temporal scale, and then on that scale, things would look homogeneous. Sure, sure. But it's much easier to just fix the scale and say, you know, just take a look at these equations and, you know, where you get a spatial term, it's multiplied by this tiny factor, and so you don't need to worry about it. Gary, you had a question or comment?
I had been under the impression that this decoupling of different spatial points could be interpreted or understood as a result of sort of different points going out of causal contact. You're approaching a space like singularities, so points cannot communicate after a certain time.
Yeah, that's... Yeah.
So that sort of said they have to evolve independently.
Right.
But now that you've sort of worked with rescaled variables, you know, in a homogeneous context, if you rescale, then you don't lose causal context.
Yeah, but the physical light cone is shrinking.
Yeah.
But the physical light cone is different.
Yeah. I mean that... So
it doesn't change by conformal rescaling.
Well, I mean, but the time coordinate that's being used here is not proper time. So you want to think of this sort of time variable as being something like logarithm of proper time. And so the idea is, as you're getting closer to the singularity, there really isn't, you know, sort of much physical time left. And so things are going out of causal contact. I mean, that's sort of an intuitive way for why you might think that the spatial derivatives become less important. But it's not conclusive in the sense that, you know, hey, it's a singularity and all sorts of nasty things are happening. And, you know, why couldn't it be that, you know, the nasty things that happen are in just such a way as to compensate for this?
So there is a more quantitative comparison where you can see the rate at which these spatial derivatives are becoming negligible is somehow comparable to the...
You can do something like that, but there's no simple relation between the two. They go like different powers of the time. Yeah.
I actually don't understand this argument. I mean, if you're evolving to the future, how does it know? I mean, then at each slice, you don't know when the singularity will come.
Right.
What, so why does it matter that to the future it's out of causal contact?
Well, if it's future, then you should look at the other.
Well, I could understand if you're right, you go from the singularity backwards.
Just the evolution at this point can't be effective.
At any fixed time.
At any fixed time, you still have
if
full.
If something's happening over here, there's no time left for.
But along your slices, that's always the case. They're always.
No, there's.
No. Look at this pool.
Not necessarily. Early. Collapse.
Different events of the same spatial slice, of course, don't affect each other.
No, but there's time for the signal to reach the evolution of the other spatial point, except as you approach the singularity, there is.
I can see what you're saying, Veronica. If you could think about a differential equation, if you're at a point, you want to just go infinitesimally future in time, you know, you never need anything more than infinitesimally different space.
Yeah, but you have spatial derivatives essentially connect different points of space to each other. Just look at David's difference equation. Let's say the value here depends on the value there. And the point is that part of the equation becomes dynamically unimportant compared to what's happening in the time.
Yeah. Let me ask another question. What's the role of the Planck length? It
isn't there yet, but I will get to that. So actually, I should probably go on. If I haven't answered your question by the end, ask it again. But let me get to the one. So the point is that what we do is we find in the simulations that the spatial derivatives do become negligible. And so what that means is that the only interesting part of the dynamics left is just to sit at some particular spatial point and ask what happens. And so what happens is the following. And this is sort of a funny diagram which you actually want to read from right to left. So the idea is 0 is our original time. Remember, this t is a logarithmic coordinate, log of time to the singularity. So it goes to minus infinity as the singularity is approached. And now what I'm doing is I'm graphing the diagonal components, basically the eigenvalues of the rescaled shear. So what you find is that you start here, things slosh around for a little while, and then what you have is well-defined epochs where the shear takes on, or the rescaled shear takes on constant values, punctuated by short bounces where it changes from those values. So recall, though, that even though this quantity isn't blowing up, it's the scale invariant one. So as you go towards the singularity, all physical quantities are blowing up, in fact, exponentially in this time coordinate. But these rescaled quantities are remaining nice and, in fact, have this nice, simple behavior. These bounces, although they're rapid, are not infinitely so, and the behavior can be found by them.
There's a solid line and a dotted line
here? So there's actually three different lines, the solid line, a dotted line, and a dot dashed line, and these are the three different eigenvalues of the shear tensor.
What determines the timescale
it
takes for these bounces?
So I'll get to that on the next slide. So it turns out that these bounces are induced by this spatial curvature or spatial Christoffel symbol, whatever you want to call it. What happens in between a bounce is that each component of this spatial curvature is something which is fairly small, but one of them is exponentially growing, and the time scale that it takes for that quantity to get to one and induce a bounce is basically the time scale that it takes. Again, there probably is some, you know, formula that you can calculate, but the basic idea is that in any given one of these epochs where the shears are constant, these spatial curvatures Two of them are going down exponentially, and one of them is growing exponentially. So the reason why it takes a while for the bounce is that this thing, which is going to grow exponentially and cause a bounce, was exponentially suppressed in the previous epoch, and now it needs a while to grow again. So there probably is some simple formula that one could use from the initial conditions to calculate the rate of the bounce.
So that's but, another naive yeah. question. How uh-huh. would curvature get an opposite sign of this potential negative curvature, right?
Wait, positive curvature?
You're talking about the spatial curvature.
Oh, yeah. So, right. So it turns out that all that matters for the bounce is the square of this spatial curvature quantity n. So positive or negative will give a bounce, but zero won't.
It's not curvature, right? I mean, it's connection. Right?
Yeah, okay, connection.
It's not connection.
Okay, spatial connection then. So,
presumably, I mean, these rescaled variables can be re-expressed in terms of unrescaled variables.
But there'll be another derivative coming in.
To ones, right, but I mean, these are just the same bounces I was talking about.
Yeah, it's the same bounces.
Same growing potentials, it's just in different variables, but it's the same mechanism.
I think, just for most of us who don't do new work here. So, these really are you're looking at this the right hand side of the spatial commutators, which you have right. I mean, and it's their magnitude, which is what is determining the.
That's right. I mean, one way to look at it is really what Beverly was just saying. I mean, the formula for the Ricci tensor does indeed involve derivative of connection, but it also involves square of the connection. And it turns out in this case that the thing that's dominant is not the derivative of the connection, but the square of the connection. So this is also sort of the answer to Eva's question. It really is spatial curvature itself that's causing the bounce, but the spatial curvature comes in square of connection, and that's why it doesn't matter whether the connection is positive or negative, because it's square that's coming into this.
But ordinary spatial curvature can have either side, so you're taking a square in a different sense than the square that appears in the actual curvature.
So I'm not sure which sign. Yeah, I'm not sure which sign comes in, but in any case, no matter which sign the spatial connection has, all the bounces are the same, and all the bounces are caused by squares of this spatial connection, not by anything else, and all with the appropriate sign. I mean, I'm not exactly sure why it comes out the same sign in all cases, but it does.
When you choose your initial data, have you taken cases? I guess you can't put a metric with positive scalar curvature everywhere on the torus.
No.
But have you taken the cases where the scalar curvature is negative, say, over?
Sure. In general, in the initial data, the scalar curvature is, you know, negative in some places and positive in other places.
And
it doesn't matter. No, it doesn't make a difference.
The square of that thing, it's not really exactly, I mean, the dominating factor or something.
So it's just the naive square.
It's a naive square. That's what it is.
Yeah.
So the direction it goes locally will depend on the sign of the curvature. But you're saying the bounce itself.
Yeah, the bounce itself just depends on there being curvature. So this shear in a given epoch, well, so it's because it's a shear, it's trace free, and in a given epoch, its square is fixed to be a certain thing. So as Beverly said, it can be characterized by a single quantity u, and one can measure that quantity u, and in the simulation, sure enough, in each of these bounces, it goes down by one, except when it was smaller than two to begin with, in which case u goes to one over u minus one. So the simulations also show this this BKL law.
You see this at every point.
Yeah. Different u's obeying the same bounce rule at every point of the simulation.
Every plot has one point and time, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so now let me, I promised Rob I would show a movie. So this is, hang on a second. So this is now a case where there is symmetry in one direction, and I just want to show you some of the difficulties associated with a spike. So here, this is just a movie of the shear. And we start out with the shear having a particular value, and then it bounces to some other value. But there's a set of measure zero where the old stuff gets left behind. On a simulation, it's a little bit tricky to resolve these spikes because they get smaller and smaller. And in fact, the simulations that I showed you were run with about 50 by 50 by 50 points, which really isn't quite enough to do a good job of resolving the spikes. Franz Pretorius, Lars Anderson, Wei-Chet Lim, and I are working on doing these simulations with parallelism and adaptive mesh refinement so that we can, you know, show you some movies that actually do resolve spikes, but that's for the future. If you use a scalar field or a stiff fluid, then you get a similar sort of thing, except there's a last bounce, as Beverly was saying the other day, and here's some results, again, for the shear. For the stiff fluid case, where you sort of bounce for a while and then you don't bounce anymore. Since I'm running out of time, I'm going to just sort of quickly run through the rest of this stuff and say what the implications are, and then I'll take some questions at the end. Okay, so basically the result is that this BKL conjecture appears to be correct. Spatial derivatives do become negligible. Everything locally looks like Bianchi 9. What remains to be done, you know, along these lines is to, so far I've only done vacuum and scalar field. Other types of matter need to be looked at. As I said, the small scale structure is not resolved in these simulations. That needs to be looked at. And as Beverly said, it's expected that a different sort of singularity, a null one, appears in part of the collapse to a black hole, and that needs to be looked at as well. So now I get to what's for me the fun part of the talk. Since this is a conference on the quantum nature of singularities, the question is, what's the implications of all of this for the quantum nature of singularities? No, because I have to, I have 30 seconds to complete the next two transparencies. But I'll call on you immediately afterwards. Okay, so. So in these, you know, next two transparencies, what I get to do is to outline this, you know, grandiose program of research to be carried out by people other than me, and so that's why it's the fun part for me. Although I should, you know,
that's why it's grandiose.
Yeah, well, that's true too. Although I should warn you that I've already mentioned, you know, these ideas to Gary and to Eva, and they seem totally unimpressed. So maybe the rest of you will be too. Anyway, so here's the idea. So first of all, even though Robertson Walker is you know, important for the early universe, it's basically irrelevant for gravitational collapse because, as Beverly said the other day, gravitational collapse is dominated by shear, not matter, and so it's never homogeneous and isotropic, and matter doesn't matter. So while you know, a lot of work about how to resolve FRW is going to be very important for talking about the early universe, it's not going to tell us directly about gravitational collapse. Okay, what about Schwarzschild? Well, locally, things look like Mixmaster, but Mixmaster in each of these epochs basically looks like the Kasner spacetime, as Beverly said the other day, and Schwarzschild also looks like a special case of the Kasner spacetime. So resolving Schwarzschild is a good thing to do, but it's only a special case. The other thing, this gets back to Steve's question, is that we don't really need to worry about the complications of Mixmaster. Mixmaster has an enormous number of bounces, but on one of those bounces, you're going to get to the Planck scale. And in fact, in the simulation I showed you, you know, there were maybe five or six bounces. And if you look to see how much things shrink, what you find is that from the beginning of the simulation to the end, you've gotten from about the scale of a solar mass to the Planck scale. So the moral of the story is that, you know, while Mixmaster master is something that's very important for sort of classical relativity. It is more complicated than Kasner, and for the purposes of the quantum nature of singularities, you really don't need to worry about that. Mixed master is a series of Kasners, and one of those Kasners, you're going to hit the Planck scale. That's the thing that you should worry about. So the main thing to do is to just concentrate on Kasner. What can we say about resolving the singularity of Kasner using quantum methods? And so now...
Can you clarify what you mean by that? Kasner with...
Arbitrary indices and any power law, because you all of them. Okay, and so what I want to do is to...
about symmetry.
Oh, I'll get to that in a minute. Okay, so in fact, this transparency is supposed to answer the question that Ted just posed, or really to reformulate it as a different sort of question. So I want to add this as question five, added to Gary's four questions, although maybe you added a fifth one and this should really be question six. I think it's going to be crucial to ask and answer the question, is there some analog of the BKL ansatz for quantum gravity? In other words, quantum gravity is you know, really complicated, a lot more complicated than classical general relativity. But it is possible that certain terms in the equations of quantum gravity are the dominant ones as one approaches the singularity. And so... In a nutshell, my grandiose program of research is to ask and hopefully answer the question, is there some analog of the BKL ansatz for quantum gravity? Can we guess which terms in the quantum gravity theory that we're going to be using are the dominant ones near a singularity? Can we then throw out the rest and concentrate on asking what singularities look like in this truncated theory?
So that... might depend on which quantum gravity you're talking about.
Yes, right? Yes, exactly. So this is sort of the reason why Gary and Eva are not impressed, because they don't think that this sort of approach lays well with our current understanding of string theory. But Abhay is much happier, because there are current developments in loop quantum gravity, which Abhay is going to tell us about in a day or two, which are along these lines and do seem to resolve particular kinds of singularities. So the really nice thing about, you know, having both Abhay and Gary and Eva here is that Abhay's talk can you know, sort of get these guys, you know, jealous and annoyed and upset, and then, you know, motivate them to sort of do this stuff in string theory. anyway, so, yeah.
It strikes me that we don't need any of the three of us here, since you're telling us everyone what to think.
Point taken. Okay, so anyway, this is my last transparency, and after that I'll be quiet and you know, everybody can speak for themselves. Okay, so the basic idea is just that this BKL ansatz, you know, was just a guess in the late 60s and early 70s, but now due to this program of numerical research that Beverly and Vince started, we have convincing evidence that things really do work this way, and that as we approach the singularity, you know, various terms that Bilinski, Kolatnikov, and Lifshitz told us were negligible really are negligible, and that in some sense singularities really are fairly simple. So if something similar holds in quantum theory, then quantum singularities may be tractable too. And so this is the sort of, you know, grandiose suggestion that I have for other people to carry out. And since it is for other people to carry out, as Steve points out, I can be as grandiose as I like. Okay, so that's basically it. Thank you. Okay, so I promised to call on Don, and then after that, it's a free-for-all.
I just understand the technical point of the classical situation for the mixed master case.
Okay.
So Beverly mentioned in passing that in that case, the spikes, quote, move around. I want to understand, how much do they move? I mean, do they move a lot? But I would think that that would say that the conjecture is not, strictly speaking, true. If I stand at one point and it's likely that a spike passes me, then at some point in my future evolution, the spatial derivatives were removed.
So So, I mean, in numerical relativity, you have not only a foliation, but also a threading. You have to say not just what the slices are, but also what the observers are. In this particular threading, where you just go perpendicular to the foliation, the spikes don't seem to move a lot, so it doesn't seem to be an issue. But I can't swear to that because these are low resolution studies that do not sufficiently resolve the spikes. So I can't give you a definitive answer. But my guess is that if you choose the foliation and threading that I'm using, that it's not a problem.
So definitely was referring to a different foliation.
Yes, and a different threading.
Okay, great.
But isn't the statement that you're, even if the spikes spatial derivative are smaller than the time derivative of the coordinates you're using?
Yes.
At the spike?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yes.
But you said that you should focus only on the Casanova behavior. Wouldn't you think that if you quantize the system, say with Guido de Witt or whatever, then what you have is that the wave function is smeared on the entire BKL chamber? But that's really the most dominant effect because classically, you have some trajectory that's mixing you within this entire chamber.
Well, I'm sure you can cook up a wave function that has that form, but the question is, what will the wave function look like, if you start with a semi-classical state peaked around a classical space-time, and then I wouldn't particularly expect that.
You don't mix enough, and the result is not universal, but your asymptotic behavior.
See, you don't get to mixed master asymptotia. That's my whole point. I mean, mixed master involves an enormous amount of ergodic mixing after 100 bounces or so. You know, you don't have 100 bounces. You have a few bounces before you get to the Planck scale. And so I really don't expect either classically or quantum mechanically for there to be any kind of ergodic mixing at all. The point is that after a short amount of time, you hit the Planck scale. And then you have to do something completely different. So this is why I'm saying don't worry about mixed master. I mean, mixed master and its chaotic behavior is a beautiful mathematical and classical relativistic problem. But I think that in some sense, all those subtleties are going to be irrelevant for the quantum theory. And the reason is that you don't have that many bounces, and each in between bounces, everything looks like Kasner. So I expect nothing to differ from mixed master to Kasner. Abai?
I can actually two questions, but one for Ted and one for Martin, actually. So Ted, you are asking a question then. What symmetry? What do you mean by that?
When you said concentrate on Kasner, are
you
talking about perturbed Kasner, arbitrarily perturbed with no symmetry, or what do you mean by concentrate?
So this is sort of the heart of the matter. One possibility is that a BKL ansatz of just exactly the form that it is in classical relativity also holds for quantum theory. And that in quantum gravity, there is some sort of well-defined way of saying in this regime, the spatial derivatives are negligible, and the quantum answer is exactly what you would get if you were doing the quantum gravity of a homogeneous spacetime. If things are really true in that strong form, then in some sense, Abai and Martin already have the answer to the quantum nature of singularities, because they have a loop quantum gravity, or at least within loop quantum gravity, because they have a loop quantum gravity treatment of Kasner. So I think that it's important to first of all, in whatever version of quantum gravity you're doing, see whether there is any sensible way of doing the Kasner singularity, and then ask within that approach to quantum gravity, is there any sensible way of saying that in the quantum theory the spatial derivatives are negligible, even though things depend a lot on space? It may not be as simple as that at all, right? I mean, it may be that the things that are negligible in classical relativity become hideously non-negligible in quantum gravity. And it may be that But at least it's worth looking at. And even if they, even if these particular things that are negligible in the classical theory don't remain negligible in the quantum theory, I think it's still worth asking the question, near a quantum singularity, are there things that are sufficiently negligible that one can throw out, and can one then make some progress with the truncated theory that's left? This approach has proved so useful in the classical case that I've got to believe that it's at least a good thing to try in the quantum case.
Yeah, my second quick question, Robert. When you said several things about, just now in response to some people, about mixed master, mm-hmm. why we should look at Kasner and not mm-hmm. mixed master, why there will be only finite bounces.
Yeah.
I think there's a nice analysis that Martin and other people have done using effective equations which come from loop quantum gravity.
Uh-huh.
And maybe you can tell us what happens.
Well, the best adjustment you have even less bounces if you use these effective equations because these walls are not infinitely high but break down because these are curvature walls. So if uh-huh. you have quantum effects which lead to boundedness of curvature in a sense, then you have only walls of finite height and at some point you would just run over them.
Hmm.
But since you say you have anyway only about five bounces, maybe you just had four because of this effect.
Okay. Okay, that's nice to know. Jorge?
What's your hunch about how BKL will apply when you have collapsed rotating matter? You have collapsed rotating matter, the interior of that thing is going to be curved because the Cauchy horizon will collapse and so on. The metric will have theta dependence and so on and so forth. So how is that going to be isomorphic to Kasner?
This dynamics is local. So in the center of any collapsing matter, rotating or otherwise, I expect this stuff to apply. Near the Cauchy horizon, there's this null singularity stuff, which hasn't been well explored numerically. The ideas of Eric Poisson and Werner Israel for how the null singularity should behave will probably turn out to be right, but it needs a lot more exploration. So there's nothing special about matter rotating or otherwise. I mean, as Beverly said yesterday, we believe that near these singularities matter doesn't matter, and the reason is that they become Yeah, so it doesn't matter. I mean, eventually gravity becomes strong enough that you get lots of shear. And then once you do that, the shear becomes the dominant factor and it behaves in exactly this way. It doesn't matter whether you have matter or rotation.
Okay. Here you are going to say spaceless singularity, yeah. A little bit in the null piece.
Yeah.
Now I actually look at some foliation that you have, maybe constantly.
Yeah.
And I look at a trajectory which goes into the null piece.
Yeah.
That's what he wants to look at.
Yeah, okay,
then
so.
He's saying that why this should such trajectories look anything like Kasner bounces?
They won't. So the null singularity really is supposed to be very different from this, and it's unfortunately something that we can't explore with these sort of compact Cauchy surface methods. So I mean, to a certain extent, the null singularity is a separate subject and is. To a certain extent, terra incognita as far as the numerics goes. There are some spherically symmetric simulations, but one needs to go further than that. Let's see. Oh, yeah, Ted?
I just wondered, at the bounces, if you look at a strict invariant like a curvature tensor squared, is that becoming large?
Yes.
At the bounce event.
Oh, at the bounce events. Well, it's just becoming monotonically large. Nothing special happens to it during a bounce. It goes monotonically. I mean, the easiest way to think about it is to think about the formula that Beverly showed the other day, where you have curvature invariant is 1 over t to the 4th times this stuff involving u. Okay? So the 1 over t to the 4th is always there. And so as you get closer and closer to the singularity, that stuff is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. At a bounce, because u changes, the prefactor changes, but it just changes to another.
The curvature becomes large at a bounce.
Yes.
Large.
Yes.
And what about at spikes? That's my other question. Is it also true that the curvature at a spike is no bigger than in the neighborhood?
Yeah, it's not particularly much bigger than in the neighborhood.
I think in the derivatives, the curvature might be.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it's not necessarily large. It depends on how fast it turns around. Or is it that?
Yeah, no, that, I mean, so the spike is a spatial feature, and so because it has, you know, big spatial derivatives, you might worry that the curvature becomes large there. But again, those big spatial derivatives are being multiplied by these you know, tiny prefactors. So it's not really much of an issue. I mean, basically, the curvature does, you know, what you would expect. You go towards the singularity, and the closer you are to the singularity, the higher the curvature is, and it blows up when you get there. Steve?
This is sort of a qualitative question, but sort of what's the figure of merit? I mean, how do you know sort of like what, when you can start ignoring spatial gradients? Like you want this curvature invariant when it's big, you know, when it's, I don't know, when it's so large, the gradient terms will be a 1% effect. I mean,
let's see. Let me go back to.
I guess the curvature invariant defines an inverse length scale. And that's the thing that multiplies the gradients or something? I mean, that's...
Gradients
are sub-leading walls. And you have these leading walls, but then there are other walls that are filtered out.
Walls? Yeah, no, I know what you mean, but I'm just...
Right. Yeah, so... So I mean, all spatial derivatives. So I mean, other than at the spikes, things don't you know, change all that rapidly with space. And so the point is that in the equations of motion, all spatial derivatives appear multiplied by this rescaled frame vector E. Essentially, E is the figure of merit.
Undo the rescaling.
Yeah, but I mean, essentially, E is this capital E is the figure of merit.
That's a dimensionless
figure
of merit. Okay, so
yeah.
If I want to like express that in terms of curvatures and things, this curvature invariant squared defines that blows up like 1/(t^4) or something.
Oh, I see.
So that defines some length.
In this sort of, you know, logarithmic time variable, basically everything that you can think of is you know, some exponential of that time. So I guess you could sort of undo that and just ask, you know, like what power do each of these things go? So there isn't a sort of a particularly simple answer. I mean, different components of E will go like different powers, but they're all, you know, going down, and the curvature itself goes like some power. So I don't think there's
well,
sort of particularly.
Well, question about how close we have to get to the singularity to when we want to make this approximation. You know, I mean, there's some.
Yeah.
Some don't want to do it just inside the Schwarzschild horizon of.
Right.
Supermassive black hole. So.
So if I go back to this picture, I mean, you want to think of this as a logarithmic coordinate,
right.
And if you think of this as a solar mass,
yeah.
And this is the Planck scale,
right.
Things start becoming negligible about here, right? So, I mean, you know, much smaller than a solar mass and much bigger than the Planck scale. I mean, is sort of the best I can do at this point. Yeah. Well, yeah. That's the best I could do.
You know, I think in some sense that will be initial conditions.
Yeah, it's a question of the initial fluctuations, right?
Because initially you get all sorts of things happen that are not detail-like, and that dies away.
And if you have exactly Schwarzschild data, nothing will happen.
It dies away at different rates at different spatial points also.
Right.
In other words, at some point it becomes
active.
Right.
I'd ask this question in a slightly different way if I could.
Yeah.
I mean, if I want a space-time with an arbitrary number of bounces before the curvature reaches the Planck scale, I can do it, right? You just take any of your solutions up to, you know, as many bounces as you want, multiply that entire metric by a very large constant,
sure.
You dilute the curvature,
sure.
You get the curvature down below the Planck scale.
Yes.
Okay, so what is the sort of sense in which you're saying you only get a few bounces? I mean, you're starting with...
Because it's a logarithmic.
Yeah,
but there's some assumption.
And
about
you take
what
the ratio.
Yeah,
but your time is the log of the volume, and so you take a ratio of let's say the Hubble volume.
But our universe could be much bigger than the Hubble volume
today. Right.
So if your gravitational collapse situation is much, much bigger than the known universe, then yeah, you can, you know, come up with a much larger number of bounces to the Planck scale. But I mean, if you put in, you know, realistic data at the solar mass scale, it's just not going to take that many bounces to get to the Planck scale.
You're thinking about cosmology. You're thinking about black holes.
Yeah, I'm thinking about black holes.
Right. So the black holes still have to answer it, right?
Yeah, and even if I...
Whether the mixed master is relevant for quantum gravity, and if you can think of a situation which is irrelevant, then they should be relevant for quantum gravity.
Yeah. Maybe you regard the quantum fluctuations at the horizon being Planck length over Schwarzschild radius, you know, some small, so they're small. If that's the size of the randomness and initial conditions, when do you start crazy?
Well, actually, I was going to make another suggestion, and that is you start with some mass and have fluctuations also on a scale given by that mass, by the Schwarzschild size.
No, because if you're really collapsing some star,
presumably, you're going to have a classical
situation. So that's basically what this is.
And then the question might be, so what power of the mass sets the scale for where this onsets under that kind of generic condition, initial condition?
It's still relativity, so it's still scale invariant. So there has
you might say at what's the typical curvature radius where this kind of thing sets in? It's bigger than the Planck scale, you said, and it's smaller than the Schwarzschild radius.
Yeah.
So it's somewhere between the power of m to the first and m to the zero.
Yeah.
So what's the power?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll have to look at that more closely.
M to the first because it's scale invariant.
Right. Oh, okay. So it's just m to the first.
It's just from the original structure.
Just because of scale invariant, you say. Okay.
Generic order one perturbations at some scale size.
I see. Okay. So it's relatively early. Okay.
Other questions or comments? Since I've been putting lots of words in, you know, Gary's mouth and Eva's mouth and Jave's mouth, maybe I should, you know, give him a chance to set the record straight.
Well, I just am deeply disappointed that Gary didn't throw his gauntlet because of that.
Okay. 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 Point taken. Gary, or have you had your say already? Okay, Steve.
No,
Martin.
Just to get confirmation. If you say mixed master or cosmos, it's always diagonal. So, is there any role that these off-diagonal components of the metric would play? There would be a point where they could be comparable to the spatial gradient, for instance, or are they always?
The other thing that Abhay and Gary should have, you know, jumped up about to object was that in addition to the choice of foliation and threading, you also have to have a choice of frame, right? If you're using a tetrad, you have to say, okay, what your frame is. So the point is that the particular choice of frame that's used in these simulations is that you choose the tetrad arbitrarily at first. The time vector is always the one that's orthogonal to the slices, and then the spatial vectors you Fermi walk or propagate. One thing that you might want to ask is, what's the transformation between the frame and the eigenvectors of the shear? So it turns out that that after a while, what you get is a fixed frame of eigenvectors of the shear with regard to the Fermi-Walker frame. And so what that means is that after a while, you can just say, I'm going to, you know, sit in this fixed basis frame, and I'm going to just look at everything in that frame. And as long as you do that, the shear is by definition or diagonal in that frame. You can show that the spatial curvature tensor n actually commutes with the shear, and so it is also orthogonal in this frame. So in some sense, you do have a preferred spatial frame at each point, and that spatial frame doesn't change much as you go towards the singularity. And so effectively, things become diagonal.
Okay, I think we should wrap it up. Thanks, David, again.